I think part of what I was setting out to show in the dissertation is, and I never really phrased it this way, it wasn't, because it wasn't the main goal. But like when it comes to the mythographic stuff, which is what I was interested in, and the, you know, cosmology stuff, in a lot of ways, the Hebraic thought wasn't really any different than ours. Like in our modern culture, we use what is sometimes referred to as rational instrumental thinking, which is kind of your cause and effect stuff, right? And then we use analogical stuff all the time. I mean, the movies.
What would be an instance of analogical reasoning?
Well, I mean, at a micro level, it's something like just using an analogy, you know. I was about to.
So just saying like, well, that's a really strong argument.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, sure. You know, and even if like, if we're talking Bible stuff, Jesus saying, I'm the gate, or, you know,
anything that forces the question, like, in what way is this like that? In what way is this not like that? Yeah.
And so I think we understand analogies usually pretty well, right? But and of course, now that I'm talking about it, I'm like, why can't I think of a single analogy? But that's kind of how it works. But okay, you know, like, oh, she's an open book. I mean, we have enough shared cultural knowledge to realize that when you say that, you're saying that this person is really open about what they think or how they feel or whatever. You don't sit there and say, oh, so she's made out of paper and has pages. Like, I mean, you know where the limits of the analogy are. And
yeah. And even the flat, it's not a metaphor, because even an open book laying on a table doesn't mean anything. It's the experience. It's actually, you're tapping into somebody's experience of reading through something that a book reveals as you
interact with it, basically. Right. Yeah. And I hadn't even thought of that. That's a good point, one. Drew. Wow.
Yeah, I like that one.
Way to
I'm
go.
I'm gonna start using that.
But yeah. So really what I was doing in the dissertation was showing, like, just as we moderns use analogies, or we also use this kind of discursive, rational, instrumental, whatever you want to call it, kinds of stuff. We can operate with both. We can hop back and forth between both. In the same way, the ancients could do that. And the part of what I was trying to get at in the dissertation is there's a lot of, do you edit these, by the way? As I was kind of thinking about it, I started to realize that in the area that I was working in the dissertation, the part of what I was doing was saying, you know what, the way they thought isn't so different from the way we think. You know, we can do our rational instrumental stuff that allows us to examine cause and effect, so that when I'm writing a computer program, I recognize that when I input the code in the correct way, I'm going to get the correct results. And we think through that cause and effect stuff. That's the rational instrumental stuff. The ancients were perfectly capable of that kind of thinking. It's what allowed them to do irrigation, build buildings, you know, all the kinds of stuff that just kind of kept life going. You know, but we all
and the super fancy mathematics that they did as well.
Yeah, right, like calculus in base 60. In the old Babylonian
base 60
period.
Meaning like every number is 60, a multiple of 60.
Yeah, it's kind of like the easy way to think of it is like our clock. You know, 60 minutes is 1 hour.
Okay.
Yeah. So
what's the technical name of that? Is it's sexagesimal?
Yeah, leave out the part. Sexagesimal.
Yeah. Yeah. Sexagesimal. Yeah. Okay.
So I once had a colleague write a poem, "You're sexagesimal, baby." And it was all about how you're base 60. But yeah. So yeah, they're capable of sophisticated mathematical calculations. They're, you know, they're not idiots. But then also they know how to use analogies. And then in their stories, they would really draw out these analogies, which we still do today in the movies. You know, with the best movies today resonate with us at some deep level, even though we might recognize that's totally a work of fiction, but we still say, "Oh my gosh, that's so true," when a character does something or acts in a particular way that really resonates with us. I am Eric Smith. I am the founder and president of the Pillar Seminary, and I'm a friend of Drew, which that's...
Not everybody can hang in there when it comes to being a friend of mine.
I know. That's really where the credibility comes from. But we met in Scotland at...
That's right.
Yeah.
St. Andrews. I forgot about that.
Yeah.
And so you wrote this dissertation. What was the title of the dissertation? Sorry, that's not fair. Put me on the spot like that. I couldn't tell you the title of my dissertation at this point.
It was something about, I think it was called The Sumerian Mythographic Tradition and Its Implications for Genesis 1 to 11 or something like that. But basically what I was trying to do was understand how these kinds of grand, awesome stories in the ancient Near East, which modern scholars or just people in general will typically look at and say, "Oh, that's a myth." But how do these things actually work? Is there truth in them? Are they totally fiction? Are they trying to make some sort of truth claims? All of that kind of stuff. And what got me on it was being interested in the opening chapters of Genesis. And honestly, feeling like, well, I don't really know how to read those opening chapters well. How might the original audience have understood this? Was the question I started asking. So that was what it was designed to answer. And the reason I went digging into all of this ancient myth and taking the time to learn the languages and the literature and do all that kind of crazy stuff, was I kept seeing in Genesis commentaries, they would always compare Genesis to things like Enuma Elish. That's the big one that would most often get compared, but to a bunch of other stuff as well. You know, Enki and the World Order and Enki and Ninhursag and the Eridu Genesis and, you know, on and on.
And these are all Mesopotamian creation or cosmogonies, the creation of the universe, or some of the gods related to how things spilled out in what we consider creation or the cosmos.
Yeah, the ones I named were all Mesopotamian, but there's Egyptian stuff as well. So yeah, digging into all that stuff. So that was the goal, was like, okay, these commentators I'm reading are comparing it to these ancient stories, so I need to go learn those ancient stories really well, which meant learning the languages and a lot of study and, you know, so on and so forth. But the goal was, okay, how do we actually understand what they're trying to claim in Genesis 1 to 11 in particular? But creation is the thing that everyone always wants to know about.
And we should note that the use of myth here, there's a kind of a technical use of myth, and then there's a popular means it's not true, it's just some fictionalized account.
Right.
And you can also have a fictionalized account that is true in some way, that it's actually meant to represent something real, even if it doesn't do it directly one for one.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Those kinds of issues are the kinds of things that I dug into. Yeah.
Yes. And if you want to hear a lot more on this and all kinds of other using the ancient Near East to think about what's going on in the Hebrew Bible, Eric and Scott Booth and Dan, what's Dan's last name?
Dan Lowry.
Dan Lowry, how can I forget that? Yeah. They have a fantastic podcast that I recommend to all my students. It's the Pillar Podcast, P-I-L-L-A-R, as an outgrowth of Pillar Seminary. It's one of the services you do.
Yeah.
And my students always listen to it and report back to me, they love it. And I tell them, of course you love it. I told you.
Well, thanks for that. So it's a great,
it's a fun podcast that is very informative, and I learn things from them all the time.
And you've been on it, just, as I recall.
Oh yeah, I was on it. That's right. It just occurred to me while you were saying this that Margaret Midgley, who's a British philosopher, I think she's passed away actually, or she's in the waning years right now, or she's passed away recently. But she's just a British philosopher, so she's not a religionist in any way. Oh, she may have some theistic ideas, but she's not like a, you know, Christian apologist. But she has a book called Evolution as Mythology, or something to that extent, where she basically she looks at the rhetoric of how the evolutionary story is actually a story. It's not, it's actually got a conflict, rising tension, you know, resolutions built into it, and how that particular story basically takes on the role of mythology in the discussion of the cosmos by scientists and philosophers of science. And it's interesting, you know, just comparing it to what you said, that we're still using mythology to reason with where we came from and how, what that, why that matters to us today.
Yeah, so for sure. I am utterly unaware of that volume. So
I just ran across it recently because somebody recommended it to me. Yeah. So from TEDS.
Oh, really? So, yeah. I mean, my shtick is a little weird because being upfront with the listeners, I know nothing about science and my concern was never actually science. So it's really interesting to me that I'm often pressed into conversations about modern science and the relationship of faith and religion, or modern science and the opening chapters of Genesis or whatever. But my whole driver in my work was I just wanted to understand the text well. I never had the evolution versus creation kind of concern. My thing.
My co-host Abby, who kind of helps me think through things, she mentioned John Walton's, or maybe she didn't name him, but she mentioned his analogy that there's two rivers, that there's the ancient Near Eastern cultural river, and then there's the kind of modern river, and he basically says you can't, you know, you have to go over there and understand them. And I kind of argue that actually all the water's connected and we're downstream, so that the Mississippi and the Nile are in some way indeed connected, and there's a way to work from one to the other, or at least to responsibly think that you can get some way in. I wonder if that, I mean, there really is this question of, can we understand what these people thought by reading their writing? Did they really think so differently from us? I mean, and I mean this in like a cognitive way, did their brains process information, as it were, so differently that we can know? That to me, it seems suggested by that two rivers analogy. And I wonder if you seem to be making a case that no, actually we think a lot like they do. We just need to kind of translate everything properly, not just linguistically, but even conceptually translate it. Am I reading you correctly on that?
Well, that's a great question.
Thank you.
I'm going to give you a really lame answer. I'm not sure I know, if I'm being honest, because even the way you phrase the question is a little foreign to me. What I mean by that is, as you know, I'm not a philosopher, right? Anytime I have a philosophical question, I go hound you or Scott. I'm a Bible guy. Mm-hmm. And so... you know, addressing the question like, were their minds different, or did their minds work differently, or whatever? I'm not really sure, and I wouldn't even know how to go about answering it if I'm being honest. Mm-hmm. Where I feel competent is the literature of the ancient Near East, and so I do see that they at times do things differently, or they think about things differently. But I've never really tried to figure out, does that mean their faculties are different, or their, I don't know, to the extent that you were raising the question, I wouldn't even know how to answer, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, I feel like after I read Mark Vandermeer's Philosophy Before the Greeks, where he's trying to make a case for Mesopotamian philosophy.
Yeah.
And he's going through all the text and omens and all the different word playing they're doing with the Sumerian to the Akkadian. And after working through that, I was like, okay, maybe these people did radically think about the world so differently that we might not ever be able to understand exactly what was going through their minds.
Yeah.
That seemed like a case for something, a radical difference. Even though I'd like to hope that they're humans like we are, made in the image of God, there's probably some bridge we could build to cross between us. But then I turn to the Hebrew Bible. I always tell my students, make them read a little bit of Enuma Elish and Gilgamesh. And then before we read Genesis 1 and 2, and I say, okay, just from a literary level, which one's easier to read and follow? You know?
Oh, what do they say?
Oh, Genesis. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Because it's so the poetry of Gilgamesh and the story of Enuma Elish, it's so, you're not even sure, are these creatures? Are these waters? Mm. Are they? You know, what is going on here? You know, they seem to be, it's actually hard to, I think we visually model things as we read, and it's very difficult to visually model. So I think most people visually model the Garden of Eden incorrectly. Yeah. They're not actually paying attention to what's being said.
Yeah.
But at least you can model something, right? You have something in your head.
Yeah.
And Enuma Elish for first-time reader is very difficult.
How much of that is just unfamiliarity with the terms? Right? I mean, Tiamat and, you know, Lachmu and Lachamu were brought forth. Like what is that? Like,
yeah.
You know, I mean, you know what I mean? How much of
it's the beauty of monotheism is you only have one name of one God to deal with. I mean, seriously, there's like, you know, these short-term memory issues, how many like digits can you remember if somebody tells you their phone number? I mean, there's a reason. It's 5 to 7 digits. It's most people. I really do think like when you're reading Enuma Elish, like once you hit the 6th and 7th and 8th God, you're like,
I'm done.
You just give up. Whatever. Yeah, I'm done.
These are all the same. Yeah.
Yeah.
So can I backtrack to your, I think before we were getting going, you made the comment about, you know, this podcast isn't necessarily for scholars. And so what's kind of on the street, some of the implications for the discussion. The main thing that I have found in working with my students that kind of, I guess, messes with their heads a little bit, for lack of a better way of saying it, is much of the what is usually called concordist readings of scripture that are out there, especially in the church today, but not just in the church, are working from incorrect presuppositions. So
define concordist really quickly.
Yeah, concordist is I'm reading an ancient text and I'm trying to correspond that with, I'm trying to make a concord between what's in the ancient text and what I know from the modern world or modern science or whatever it might be. A real easy example would be if you're reading in the Old Testament and you see the word Jerusalem and you ask the question, okay, what is Jerusalem? And is, you know, is what I know as Jerusalem in the modern world, does that line up with what is Jerusalem in the biblical text?
Right.
So you're trying to form this concord between the biblical text and what you know in the modern world. Well, the problem is that when you run into, especially creations, where it's most prevalent, but you get it in a bunch of stuff in Genesis 1 to 11, whether it's creation or the ages of people in the genealogies or the flood, waters, and where did they come from, and all those kinds of things. Most of the attempts that I see out there, and I would say almost every attempt I've ever seen at a popular level, as opposed to scholars doing the work, where they're trying to reconcile a reading of Genesis 1 to 11, what they believe Genesis 1 to 11 claims, with like modern science or what we know from science or whatever it might be, I find that more often than not, they're just off base because they haven't understood the biblical text well first. And so that's kind of the biggest I think, implication of what I might be able to offer on a podcast.
Yeah,
to, no, I, th- to I your think it's people important. Is I don't know that the ancient Hebrew authors are like fundamentally have some sort of different cognitive apparatus or something like that. I'll leave that to you to figure out.
But okay, I can I'll pretty confidently,
yeah, good. But I can pretty confidently say that they talk about these issues differently from the way that we talk about them, and they have mm-hmm. different concerns, and their method for addressing the issues is different. Mm-hmm. And when we do a better job of understanding how do they raise these issues, what are they actually concerned about, and really dig in and do the hard work of understanding how they tell their stories, why they tell them, what, you know, all that kind of stuff, then we end up with better things to go and try and reconcile or not with what we know from modern stuff.
Yeah.
Am I making any sense at all?
Yeah. I was actually just thinking of your boy, Klaus Westermann.
Yeah.
He has a great little book called Creation. I don't know if you've ever seen that, but you know, he was, after reading that, there was kind of an issue of, for me, like, all right, if I'm not, never have been and might not ever have access to the light, what it's like to be a Bronze Age or Iron Age agrarian subsistence farmer.
Yeah.
You know, he makes the point in there, like, Eden means something very different. You know, the garden description means something very different to somebody who is working day in and day out in a very difficult land. Really trying to extrude every calorie they can from this very difficult situation.
Yeah.
And so any kind of simple way of trying to, like, oh, wouldn't it be lush and nice to just live in a garden with God? It, you know, he seems to be resisting that. Like, you're missing the point if you think this is like Club Med plus, you know, to infinity. I think I even have the same advice to my undergrads. I'm the faculty advisor for the House of C.S. Lewis here at King's College. Mm. And I even have to tell them, like, look, Lewis has to be translated as well. Like, he's concerned. You know, he's a modernist. Yeah. He's a Brit modernist. He's a Church of England. You know, he tells you he doesn't know scripture any better than any man in the Church of England, which back then was pretty good.
Yeah,
but, compared to today. But, you know, he's really not concerned about the exact same things. And he's not saying things in the same way that we would say them today. And so there's this kind of like, you know, my students sometimes get caught up in this almost as if Jack Lewis could come sit in the room and talk directly to us. And I think there would actually be, if he was sitting in the room with us right now or on this podcast, we'd have to go, now, what do you mean by that again? Now, why are you all up in arms about this particular issue that we just don't care about anymore?
Yes.
So it's not even necessarily a problem of reading ancient text. It's just a problem of reading. It's the joy and struggle of reading all text and trying to communicate across cultures and including across time, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's exactly my point. And I think that's a really good example. It's a good analogy. I've heard Shakespeare scholars talk about how I have to spend so much time just translating Shakespearean English so that the students can even begin to understand what's going on.
Right.
So, you know, an easy example on the Bible side is the firmament, right? The old school translations, there's a firmament, and when God names the firmament, it's sky, right? You're chuckling.
It's so funny that it's Harikia, right?
Harikia,
And like, I keep on thinking, like, who even knows what a firmament is? Like, and what more? It's like the word midst. When does anybody say in the midst of, unless they're praying in the evangelical circle, right? You know? So even the English word is funny. I mean, I even think the word Lord is a funny English word for Americans who've never experienced any kind of royal situation. But sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, but I mean, that's the point, right? Is firmament. As you know, typically you're talking about something that is solid. The Hebrew word rakia, you know, a solid dome, basically. Mm-hmm. Well, so on the one hand, you can look at it and say the Bible is claiming that there's a solid dome, and now we know better, so the Bible's wrong. That's a concordist view where you're saying the Bible is wrong.
That comes with the implication, therefore they were irrational people.
Especially in the scholarly literature of the first half of the 20th century. Yes.
Yes.
Yes, absolutely.
Which ironically in no way logically follows from anything you said. Just to be clear.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, I assume you're aware of the fact that Vandermeerhoop is playing on the Frankfurt volume with even with
Intellectual Adventure of Ancient Man. Yeah.
Yeah. Where he had Before Philosophy was how he would talk about the ancient stuff.
That was the original title of the book.
Yeah.
Before Philosophy. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and what's really interesting is that book is basically unknown amongst mythographers, people who study myth. But in biblical studies, that really set the tone for how people think about myth for a long time.
Only in a subset of biblical study. I still run into lots of Old Testament scholars that have never heard of Henri Frankfurt or any of that work.
Really?
Torkel Jacobsen, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's part of what we're trying to do with the center is to highlight there have been people from even the University of Chicago that have been thinking about this for a long time. Yeah.
Yeah. He was an Egyptologist, by the way. Did you know that? He dug El Amarna, which is, I mean, it's interesting to me. Yeah. Yeah. So
the Rakia. Anyway. Yeah. Go back to the dome.
Yeah. Well, the only point I was trying to make is like, okay, the Bible is talking about this solid dome in the sky and it calls it sky. I guess I shouldn't say in the sky. That is the sky. This solid dome that is the sky. Well, you can look at it and go, on the one hand, the Bible got it wrong because it's not a solid dome. You know, therefore, the Bible's just wrong. You have even well-meaning evangelicals who will say, no, we're misunderstanding the word or, you know, whatever. Or another route that some people go is, well, the Bible got it wrong, but we're not relying on it for issues of science. We're relying on it for issues of faith and practice. And so it doesn't matter. And all of those approaches completely miss the analogical nature of what's going on in that passage. Mm-hmm. And so it's examples like that, where you really, I mean, the take home for the average Christian who's trying to understand scripture is, yeah, you don't need to get hung up on that. It's not an issue. Age of the earth comes up, right? Well, that's a genealogy issue. I probably shouldn't go there, should I, Drew?
No, not for this. You can listen to the Pillar podcast, though. You have some episodes that deal specifically with the use of numbers in the Hebrew Bible, which I thought was really a great episode. So
good.
I don't know what number.
I didn't actually remember that we did that.
Yeah.
So.
I'm telling you, I'm a big fan.
And
when you say you don't need to get hung up on it, I mean, there's a sense where we could say, like, look, if we could magic school bus ourselves back in time to stand alongside the Hebrews who are out Mount Sinai and be like, well, hey, what is that thing up there? Tell us more about that. They just go like, it's the sky, Shamayim. It's just like, it's the up there stuff. And God's probably above there somewhere. They think about the world differently, but I always tell my students, but if you were them, you would think the same thing and it would all make perfect sense. You know, it's only until we got up into the sky that all of a sudden it didn't make sense, or until astronomy developed to a certain level that some of it didn't make sense. So,
right.
I'm also convicted that the average churchgoer, like I had older retired ladies in my church that just served and worked and did like the basic work of the gospel that's called to. They visited the sick, they prayed with people, they helped people. Yeah. Like they understood this clearly. For them, this was not rocket science. So I'm very aware that some people hear, you know, it's a new center for Hebraic thought. We're talking about philosophy in the Bible and they think it's some brand new thing that we're, you know, new reading that's sexy to do right now.
Yeah,
and I would like to suggest that it's just a very old way of looking at the biblical text by living them out and seeing how they work, and that everybody has access to it. I mean, it's one of the things that I think is unique about the heights of Hebrew philosophy and wisdom. Everybody from a carpenter to a king has access to that wisdom. Unlike the Greek traditions of wisdom or the Mesopotamian traditions of wisdom or Egyptian. It's not classist. It's available to all.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, Eric, thank you for taking the time. As a president, I'm sure you're busy doing all kinds of things, and I hope we can have you back on the podcast.
I would enjoy that.
Thank you for listening to the Center for Hebraic Thought podcast. Be sure to subscribe, rate, or leave us a review wherever you found us. Want to learn more about Hebraic Thought? Visit our website at HebraicThought.org.